All right, so we're going to start the first keynote at this year's SOC. It gives me a great pleasure to introduce Matej Zarya, who is not only a great friend and a colleague, but also one of the most influential researchers in the systems community. Matej got his PhD. He worked with Jan Stojka. He got his PhD from UC Berkeley in 2009. We actually overlapped a little bit. I was visiting AmpLab as I was doing my postdoc. His PhD work thesis was extremely influential. Not only won the best dissertation award in computer science, it also created a multi-billion-dollar industry and still growing. So he co-founded Databricks around Apache Spark. He also is started a few other projects, including Apache Mesos. So he's currently the chief technologist at Databricks. Also an assistant professor at Stanford University. So you know, his career has been amazing. Even after starting his faculty position, he's won a bunch of awards, including NSF Career Award, Early Career Presidential Award, and so on. And today he's here with us to share some of the lessons he's seen from sort of large scale cloud software to his entrepreneurship and sort of taking his research to the real world. So. Let's welcome Matej.
Okay, thanks a lot. I figured it would be interesting to talk, since it's a cloud computing conference, about actually building a company in the cloud and delivering a service through the cloud to people. So I tried to talk about our experience doing this at Databricks and also try to highlight what's interesting from a research perspective. And this is all work that's done by a very large and fantastic engineering team that we have. So I have personally, I have a little bit to do with it, but a lot of other people are involved in making this happen. So let me start with, why did we decide to launch a company in the cloud, and why is the whole industry moving this way? I'll talk a little bit about Databricks and what our actual product is, and then most of the talk I'll spend on challenges, solutions, and also research questions that come out of, our experience there. So the cloud is eating software, in my opinion. I think in a lot of other people's opinions as well. So why is it doing that? So let's look at kind of the traditional software, the way people sold software over the past, 50 or 60 years. So the traditional model was kind of this packaged software. If you're a software vendor, you develop the software, you pack it up, and then you ship it over to customers. And it would take, usually it takes at least 6, maybe 12 months to make each release. You test the release, you put it in a nice box, you put a nice logo on it, and then you get people to start selling it. And then they have to sell it to customers with enterprise software, specifically things that a business would run. It takes at least 6 to 12 months to sell it and for them to install it and actually start using it. And then each customer then has to operate the software. So they have not only user, but an operations team that actually keeps that running in there. So it's a pretty slow cycle. A lot of things can go wrong, and then the customers have to do all this work of running the software, which is hard. In the cloud, you as the software vendor take on the operations part, and you can build and release the software through the web, and you can push releases every week, every 2 weeks. Some companies have each team just pushing releases independently whenever they want for their own service. And then customers just consume it through APIs and the web, and the result is usually that you can also support more users at each customer, and also they still have administrators and stuff, but there are fewer ops people in there, and a lot of administration functionality can be built into the software. So that's kind of the big difference. As a customer, why would you want to use this? There are actually a lot of really good reasons. So the first reason is that the management of the software is built into it. You buy them both together, and that often has a lot more value than the software bits alone, because there's another team there. There's like a professional team that's managing security, availability, updates, and all that stuff. And it actually kind of like reduces your costs to adopt and use this software, because it's actually now shared spread across many people. So that's a major reason, actually, why you may want to do it. Second reason is elasticity. In the cloud, everything is set up to be pay-as-you-go and to scale on demand, so you can try stuff. You know, if it doesn't work, you can abandon them. You can scale to a large amount quickly. That's also important. And then the other reason is that because this software is being released, you know, every week, and the development team sees users and sees all the crashes and bugs and stuff as they happen and fixes them, you just get better features and they're released faster. It's like, you know, if you go back to this slide, it would take, you know, maybe as much as 2 years until from the day a feature was built to the day you're using it in your company. This is like being 2 years in the future in terms of your software stack. And that's always nice, especially in a fast-moving field. So really good for users, and this is really taking over like pretty much the whole computing market. What's it like to build it? So it is harder to build it. There are also some benefits to it. So I'll just talk about the main differences. So one benefit for a company, and definitely one of the main reasons we wanted to do this as a startup, is this really fast release cycle means you get your stuff to users faster and you get feedback faster, and then you can improve your product and make it better. So it's super important if you want to develop a new product. You also need to maintain less stuff. In the on-premise package software world, people would be asking for support for these super old releases. You know, there are people still running Windows XP and whatever, like asking to run that. And you'd have to add patches and maintain all of these. Here, you only have to maintain two versions, basically. The current version you have deployed and the next version you're rolling out, if you roll it out incrementally. And there are also fewer configurations. So like your engineering team can focus more on actually building, you know, the things that are valuable and differentiate your product. But there's also a big kind of disadvantage or challenge that comes with this, which is, you know, for this whole thing to work, you have to be able to continuously upgrade the software without regressions, because otherwise users are not going to trust the cloud at all. And this is very different from on-premise and from pretty much any place you have to develop software. I'm sure if you go into a computer science curriculum at a university, you build lots of software, but it never has this requirement. You never have to upgrade your software after you submit it and keep it working. And the reason is on-premise, you know, the customer decides when to use it. They also have the old version. They can shift stuff back. But here, you want it to minimize, you know, the number of versions at a time. So you have to make sure it keeps working. And there are many ways regressions can happen. API, you know, semantics breakage, performance regressions, all these things. So that's a big thing. Your whole engineering process has to really emphasize this and be centered around it. The other differences are, of course, in operating it. So if you do want to have, you know, lots of customers, you'll need to design a multi-tenant service, and that means you need to tackle things like scaling and security and performance isolation that you wouldn't need to worry about on-premise, because on-premise, each customer would have their own installation, and even for things like security, even within a customer, they could just install two copies of it and just, you know, put it on a private network, and that's how they would get security. But here, you need to bake it into these centralized services that are managing everything. Then you have to operate it, of course. You have to, like, keep maintaining it day to day. Now, the interesting thing here is if you didn't do this, you know, your customers would want features that enable operation. So someone would have to do the work anyway. So it's actually better if the person building the software is also doing the work to make it operable. And then one nice thing you get is you do get monitoring, and you can see live usage that helps you operate it better. And you can also do product analytics and see, you know, we launched this feature, but everyone is getting this error message when they use it. How can we fix that? So even though there are these significant challenges and you have to build software in a different way, and in the market, the cloud software is definitely winning out, and like virtually every kind of business-to-business startup, for example, now is running in the cloud. So, and also every major effort from large tech companies. So like, it is kind of the future of software. We'll have to deal with it some way or the other. And the interesting thing is a lot of these challenges aren't explicitly studied in cloud computing research. You know, some of them are, but many of them aren't. So lots of research opportunities. So what is Databricks specifically, which is the startup that I co-founded that I'm going to talk about? So this was founded by the team that originally developed Apache Spark at UC Berkeley in 2013. And it's basically a data and machine learning platform as a service. It runs on Amazon Web Services and Azure. It just launches and manages VMs in the customer's cloud account, and it's got over 5,000 customers now. And the scale is actually quite significant. So we are launching millions of VMs per day that process exabytes of data per day. I think this is more than any private company. It's definitely also more than the cloud provider's own built-in services in many cases. We also have hundreds of thousands of users. And we have about 1,000 employees, 200 engineers. So if you think about it, you know, in terms of like VMs, like each engineer is managing, you know, 10,000 VMs or whatever. It's actually, I think it's also a very high ratio of, you know, what our engineers have to do in terms of that. And the business charges for basically compute hours that we manage in your account. That's surpassed around $200 million in annual recurring revenue this year. So this is all product revenue. It's not support or training or stuff like that. If you look at the growth of the service, it's also really interesting how quickly these types of services can grow. So this plot here is showing the number of VMs we manage each day. And we launched the service publicly in 2015. And it was growing quite fast at the start, like a factor of 4 or 5 per year in usage. So we were excited. And then last year, 2018, we were really excited because even it was getting into sort of the hundreds of millions of ARR, it was still growing a factor of 3 in 2018. Both usage and revenue grew by that factor. But then if you look at 2019, it's also, it's also grown by like at least that much already. So really fast growth. And some of it is also due to, again, the economics of the cloud model. So a customer can sign on. They can try one use case. If it works, they put it in production. It's now running every night. Then they try another use case and so on. So the existing customers grow a lot. Of course, we also grow our company. But we've only grown, for example, our number of salespeople by like closer to a factor of 2 in the past year. But usage, you see, is growing by a factor of 3. So that's one of the nice aspects of this kind of elastic model where you can just buy more of it and use it. What do people do with it? Just briefly, kind of the obligatory, you know, what do customers do slide. So there are customers in a lot of different areas. I just wanted to highlight some cool use cases. And our customers are basically technical teams, data scientists and engineers, because our product involves, you know, writing code and stuff like that. So an example is FINRA. This is the U.S. Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. They basically look at all the trades that happened in stock exchanges in the U.S., and they try to identify fraud, things like insider trading and other things that are illegal to do. And it's important to do this. People go to great lengths to evade it. So they have a lot of just basic data analysis. They also have a team that's using machine learning to do this, and they have basically 30 petabytes of trade data and lots more coming in each day where they want to quickly write these jobs and figure out these patterns and then actually produce, you know, a big stack of papers you can send to court to show that someone is doing something illegal. Biotech is another industry with a lot of things happening with data, and again, a lot of domain scientists who want to quickly and easily be able to run large-scale applications without learning how to be a software engineer. So one example is Regeneron, one of the big biotech companies. They have about 500,000 patients where they have their medical records, and they also have their DNA, and they're trying to design targeted therapy. So actually, out of this, they already designed one liver disease drug that is currently undergoing testing. And this is a trend throughout the biotech industry. A lot of companies are doing this. They all have the same kind of data and the same problems. And kind of a more fun example, Riot Games runs the world's largest online game, League of Legends, and they do a lot of product analytics and things to improve the experience in there. So they have many use cases, including finding, you know, players that are abusive and not fun to play with and making sure that they get rid of those. So these are just some of them. But in all cases, you know, these are teams of engineers or data scientists in some domain who know their domain well but want to scale up workloads easily and then have it run in production, you know, every night reliably and get it to achieve that outcome, whatever they're doing. So what do they actually do in the product? So basically, this is just a very simple diagram of what happens. There are these different types of users, you know, data scientists, engineers, maybe business users who want to just see a dashboard or something that the other people produced. And then we have this kind of integrated platform that handles a lot of the common use cases and connects to other things through just open APIs. So the top three things people are doing are interactive data science. We have this kind of Jupyter-based notebook environment, which connects really well to Spark, where you can interactively query data, and you can also turn it into a report or something that runs periodically. Scheduled jobs, you just submit some code, you want to run it, you know, every hour or every night. SQL is another huge driver of workloads, so you might use a visual analytics tool like Tableau and Qlik and just connect and submit SQL queries on the same data that's produced by your streams or whatever that do the ingest. And there are also other things like machine learning platform tools, data catalog, and also quite important is a unified security model where you can easily enforce policies across all the users in a company. And then, so this is the service that we run, and the service launches compute clusters in the customer's own account on Amazon or Azure, and then those talk to cloud storage like S3 or Azure Blob Storage. And on these clusters, we install something called Databricks Runtime, which is our kind of optimized version of Spark and other packages that actually run the jobs. So this is one thing that people sometimes find surprising. Why are we running in their account? There are a lot of good reasons to do it. One reason is their IT organization gets a lot of control about what happens. You know, what exactly can this network connect with? Can this system connect with? What else do we run next to the VMs? There's also just kind of a pricing reason where, like, a large customer might negotiate a deal, say, with Amazon to get a price reduction on storage. And we don't want to be reselling Amazon storage at a higher cost than this customer can get. So it just makes sense to do it. So a lot of other products work this way too. So that's just how we do it. And then in terms of like what code people write in the product, we really work to base everything on open source and make sure people benefit from the wide range of open source things available out there. So of course we can run Spark workloads really well, but people use everything else, you know, Python, R, TensorFlow, Scala. Some of these have nice integrations into our UI. Others are just code that you run. And since we started the company, we actually launched two other large open source projects, Delta Lake and MLflow. Both are Apache licensed. You know, anyone can use these for any purpose, including commercial. And both of them have basically thousands of companies using them. So Delta Lake is for managing storage, especially relational storage, efficiently in the cloud. I'll talk about it later. And MLflow is for managing machine learning workloads. And basically, the way we think about it is, hey, people are going to want to use open source algorithms and APIs to avoid lock-in, so we want to be really good at those. And then we will have a really great managed service that gives you all those things I said and the benefits of cloud versus just a bunch of bits. So that's what it is. And so specific challenges, so of course we have to have, we do face all the normal challenges of software as a service, availability, security, all that stuff I talked about, but the other interesting thing is that the workloads themselves are large scale. So if you think about it, you know, if one of these customers is launching 10,000 VMs and they all try to do something to our control plane service, like query the data catalog or whatever, that's a significant load you have to deal with on there. So it's very easy to imagine one job kind of overloading these services. And also because there are just a lot of VMs, there are just weird failures and things that happen. So we have to make sure that we tackle those. So it's, you get to see a little bit of both, like, you know, just running something as a service, but also of managing large-scale workloads specifically in the cloud. Okay, so in the rest of the talk, now I gave you some context on what we do and, you know, the scale and all that stuff. The next, I want to talk about four kind of things we learned. I tried to choose things that are interesting for researchers and some of what we're doing about them and what's left to do. So I'm going to talk about, first of all, what sources of problems do we see? Testing for scalability and stability, one of the things that we learned how to do well, I think. Developing control planes, and then evolving big data systems in the cloud. So first of all, what goes wrong in cloud systems? So obviously, there's a lot of academic research on things going wrong, software bugs, network configuration, crash failures, and so on. If we look at what actually causes a significant outage for us, I mean, some of those things do happen, and we catch them at various phases. But there are a lot of other things that often have a larger impact. So scaling and resource limits and how the system responds to different kinds of load, that is actually the main thing. Workload isolation, another interesting one, and then updates and regressions, this thing I talked about where you want to be able to confidently like push a new release every week and maybe roll it back but not break too much stuff in the process. So this is a plot that just shows some large outages, basically, like significant outages that we've experienced. What were the cause? And our team did a detailed analysis of this and constantly does this kind of analysis about why they're happening. So I've broken them into a few categories. So scaling problem in our services, this is code and services we control that kind of failed due to load in some way. Scaling problem in underlying cloud services, these are services we rely on where we thought we're using them in a reasonable way, but it created a problem. Insufficient user isolation is another big one. And then deployment misconfiguration, this is one of those regression things where like we push something, but shoot, the config flag was off for this customer and it should be on, or something like that happens. So at least 70% of them are only problems when you have lots of users on the same service. You wouldn't have these if you just built a service for one user. So it's a significant amount of them. So just some examples of things we experienced. These are just some of the more common things. So cloud networking, this is one example of a service we rely on that can go wrong in potentially tricky ways, especially because it's a virtual network that might not behave the same way we'd expect a network to. So limits, partitions, just being slow, like nodes taking 10 minutes to receive an IP address, hung connections, things like that. Automated job submitting a large load, I talked about it. Very large requests and results, pretty much anywhere. Slow VM launches or just lack of VM capacity. Of course, this, I don't know if we should consider this an outage per se, because there's no way they could have run that workload. But for our customers and from our perspective, it is an outage because, they rely on us to do something and we couldn't do it for them. Data corruption, writing to cloud storage, things like bit flips in memory or on the network. These are things that have happened multiple times. Just to give you a sense and maybe also highlight why it might be hard to just engineer around some of these, I just wanted to talk about one example of an outage that led to us accidentally aborting some customer jobs. And these are production jobs, they run for many hours, and the customers don't want to miss like their target to finish these and to deliver results to their own customers and so on as a result. So we have this job service that launches jobs on the customer's clusters and then just monitors them and sees how they're doing. So it can tell you, like this job failed or whatever. So that's pretty nice. We also had one customer in this specific cloud region that was submitting many jobs per second on the same cluster, just reusing it, sending lots of these little jobs. It's actually a really interesting reason is because a service or basically another product we partner with has this nice drag and drop UI where you can like set up a data pipeline, and then one of the steps you can put in it is run a Spark query on Databricks, and you can also put triggers, like for example, run this whenever I upload a new file to this storage bucket. And someone did that and then uploaded like a million files, so there were a million jobs being queued. So that's fine, it's bringing us business, it's good. But what was happening is, we're talking to this one cluster, launching these little jobs, getting results back. Some of it happens asynchronously after it runs, we fetch the results. And it turns out that actually the network infrastructure between our virtual network and these customer ones had this interesting limit here where in this particular networking setup where you can only have 1,000 connections out of each VM going between this kind of cross virtual network layer. Within your own virtual network you could have more. A flow, even if a flow lasts for 1 second, it kind of stays in this memory of this system for a few minutes. So it doesn't have to be 1,000 concurrent, it's just 1,000 transaction in a short time frame. And if you send more flows than that, it doesn't send back a reset packet or anything. It just, you know, your SYN packet disappears into a black hole. And then it takes Linux a while to time out and decide, you know, maybe this isn't happening. So that's one problem. But that's just, okay, some connections will be dropped. Maybe this one person can't run their job. Why is anyone else affected? So what was happening is, so basically our job service, you know, some things time out. What was happening, though, is these hanging connections on our side, we allocated some memory, and we expected them to finish quickly so we can deallocate that, but we couldn't do that anymore. So now we had all this memory sitting around in the JVM and garbage collection and stuff like that. And even that did not actually crash our service, which is good, but what it did do is it caused some of the health checks to the existing cluster that were running jobs to time out. So at some point we said, hey, we couldn't talk with this job and this health check failed, so we think it's probably dead, so let's shut down the cluster so the user isn't built for like running VMs that are doing nothing and tell them that the job failed. So that's what we did, and they said, no, my job was still running, why did you shut it down? So that's an example, but there's some interesting things. There are all these weird interacting resource limits and systems that push, you know, workload onto each other. And there's also this kind of non-standard network behavior that we don't really expect to see this kind of limit on number of concurrent connections. You know, it's not like we had 1,000 threads or whatever that would saturate some resource. We just had these async, you know, kind of RPCs going out. So these are some examples. So that's what happened. There are also some things that didn't happen as often as maybe I would have thought, so just kind of interesting. So, you know, you worry about, like, can cloud providers restart your VM anytime? It only happened once, from what I saw, where Amazon wanted to restart all its VMs in a holding manner to update a Zen security patch that required that kind of restart. We have a lot of people, like a lot of cloud providers, monitor your VMs and tell you if, you know, someone seems to have compromised them. So one time, a customer ran a job on a VM, then they released it, and then another customer started running malware on the same physical machine, but they got a message that said, hey, your Databricks, like, VM had malware on it, and you know, they freaked out, but it turns out actually it wasn't, you know, it was just owned by another customer at that time. One significant S3 outage, I remember, that took down a region, and we had one kernel bug. You know, kernels actually work pretty well, but there was one bug where basically TCP connections would get hung, and this led to similar problems to what I talked about before, and it was very rare. We have a blog post on it if you want to see more. So some lessons from here, cloud services need to handle load that varies in many dimensions, and they also rely on other services. And this is just gonna get worse as more and more people stack stuff on each other, but it's great to be able to do that, to like actually get the benefits of people specializing in building these things. And especially these end-to-end issues are hard to prevent. There is, of course, a lot of engineering stuff you can do, and we do, like minimizing mean time to recover, you know, monitoring, testing, just having good culture about how you run a service. But there are still kind of fundamental things, I think, in how you build this that are different. So that's what goes on. What are we doing in response? So I'll just show some things that we're doing. So one of the things that we developed, and I think that really made a difference, is a methodology for testing for scalability and stability. So this affected everything in our product and in Spark, actually. We improved Spark a lot by doing this. So software correctness, if you think about it, is usually just a Boolean property. Do you do the right thing given some input or not? If you think of these scale-related issues, any system that has limited resources is gonna fail to meet the incoming load at some point if it's high enough. So it will fail in some way. It will definitely, like, it can't keep scaling forever. But the questions are really, what load does that happen at? Is this changing over time? Like, you know, did you just reduce the load when you made a patch? And also, what actually happens when you fail? Does it gracefully, you know, decline some requests? Does it just slow things down? Does it crash everyone? You know, does it randomly crash other people's workload? These kind of things. So this is kind of what happens. So I'll just tell you about kind of our most basic service, which is interactive data exploration in a notebook that connects to Spark. So you think about it, how hard can it be? You take something like Jupyter, you take Spark, you put it, you know, you put it in a web browser and like have at it and, you know, go explore data. But it turns out a lot of things could go wrong in this, and improving the stability of this was a major win for us and major differentiating factor from other cloud services. And so you'll notice there are a lot of different components involved in, you know, the user typing something to a command actually running in Spark on workers. So here are some examples of things, all of which happened basically within the first year of us giving this to customers that would create issues. So one example is you just have a large result, like you have your query returns lots of data, or maybe, you know, we have a limit on how many records we'll display, but one of your records is like a gigabyte in size or things like that. All these things can happen. That can actually crash things anywhere along this chain. So we've crashed the user's web browser by giving them that gigabyte record. We've crashed our notebook service. We crashed this app that talks to Spark. We also crashed Spark itself and sometimes code on the workers. So, and there are many ways a result can be big, including having lots of columns or having lots of rows or having an individual really large thing. Large record in a file, similar thing when you read data and decompress it. Large number of tasks, they just submitted a job with like, you know, a billion map tasks, and then we do something that maybe is more than linear in those. Code that freezes a worker, so this worker, you know, just dies, and the rest of the system doesn't expose this problem to the user, so they don't know what's happening. So all these things can happen, and because users want to use the cloud in a multi-user way, and they have multiple people working on something, there are also other users sharing this cluster. So all these things, if one user does them, it can mess up other users, and it's essential to actually support multi-users and not tell them, well, you know, launch another 100 VMs for each of your data scientists so they can work productively. So how did we approach this? So we actually built a number of stress test frameworks that work in the same way. So basically what we do, first we identify the dimensions you can increase the workload in, and it turns out actually just pushing one dimension at a time is usually enough to catch most issues, because some resource saturates, and there's some dimension where if you just push on that, it will saturate it and you'll see that behavior. So you don't need to do all combinations necessarily. So we just identified, I mean, you know, number of users, number of output rows, size of each, you know, there's like dozens of these dimensions. We just grow the load in each dimension, just increase it exponentially until something fails. And then we record both, you know, when did it fail and what was the impact. So, you know, was it a timeout? Did it give the wrong result? Did it affect other clients? And also, did we auto-recover? We would like to auto-recover from these and give you a meaningful message about what happened. And then we compare them over time and whenever we make a change to the code. So just as an example of output from one of our early frameworks, which was actually in a Google Sheet, we just copy-pasted this output into it. These are like two runs of it, and you can see there are different suites in here, and for each one there's like a maximum value of bytes or whatever where the thing failed. There's an error message if it gave a message, and then this is the previous one, and you can see regressions, like this thing failed at an earlier step or maybe this thing improved over time. So this kind of framework helped catch a ton of issues and lead to a way better experience where they don't have to call support or whatever to have it work. It just kind of works and they can fix it on their own. Obviously seeing what causes problems was important for that. Next thing I'll talk about is developing control planes. So we have to build a lot of these services. How do we do it? And every company in the cloud is doing something of this form. And I think this is an interesting area for research if you're interested in programming models or software development tools or whatever. It's not just a debugger and like whatever. There's a lot of other things involved in these. So cloud control planes have many interacting independently updated services which call each other, so how should you program it? Just some examples of services. So we have something called the cluster manager service. This is what everything uses to acquire compute nodes in those customer accounts. So the API is, I just want to launch a cluster, maybe scale it up and down or shut it down. And it's supposed to request VMs from the cloud provider, which is another service, install stuff on the VMs, you know, set up the network connectivity, and it also has has this nice feature where, you know, it can take a while to acquire VMs, so we can keep them in a pool and reuse them for future clusters, so you can have these really fast, short-lived jobs and not have to wait 10 minutes to spin up a VM. And it's got a bunch of state to match, and some of its state is in the outside world. Like if a VM magically disappears from the cloud provider, we need to realize that that happened and do something meaningful with it. Okay. Another example is the job service I talked about. You set up jobs, or you say, okay, trigger this job through the API, and it talks to the cluster manager to get a cluster, and it then talks to the job and stuff to monitor it, and it has to remember, you know, what jobs are running, where are they, and by the way, some of our jobs can take like days to run, so these things have to maintain that state across updates as well, and even if they crash. And then these things call each other, and there are also other things that call them, such as, you know, the service that does billing, an important part if you want to actually bill customers for usage. Of course, they also talk to the cloud provider. So that's the kind of mesh you get. So how do we quickly build and maintain these? So we build, a lot of other companies do the same, basically a framework where you can come in as an engineer and just start writing a service, and a lot of stuff is available around it. And we use a lot of open source components to do this. So this handles deployment. We use Kubernetes to get a uniform way to deploy stuff across the different clouds. Testing, you can spin up all of Databricks locally and test it. Storage management, things like databases and migrations. Security tokens, you know, your service shouldn't have too many permissions to do bad things. Monitoring, API routing, feature flagging, all these kind of things you need to then maintain the service. So some things we learned. So first of all, isolating state is important. So we just use relational databases. They work well, but we are careful with sharding. Isolating components that scale differently. So this is where if your service is doing many things, it might be better to have a different pool of compute resources for each one. Managing changes through feature flags. We tried a lot of ways, and feature flags, everything new we build always has a feature flag because it's the fastest and safest way we found to undo things. Watching key metrics. So interesting, most metrics could be predicted just from resource exhaustion of things like CPU and database load, and not really for service-specific reasons, so we watch those closely. And then a test pyramid with, you want everything, like anything that happens, you want most of it to be testable just through unit tests so developers can develop quickly. And that can be hard to do, so you write the code to enable that. Okay. And then the final thing I'll talk about is evolving big data systems for the cloud. So I'll just briefly mention some stuff we're doing. So this is the software we run. So MapReduce, Spark, all these things were designed for on-premise data centers, and so they don't fully embrace the capabilities of the cloud. For example, elasticity, multi-tenancy, all that stuff. So, of course, we want to offer the best service that will win in this kind of cloud world, so we are evolving all of these to work well there. And I'll just talk about a couple of things we're doing. Delta Lake is an open source project for data management, and then also making Apache Spark cloud aware. So Delta Lake, the background here is, you know, cloud object stores like S3 are awesome storage systems, very low cost, very available, very high parallel I/O bandwidth, and everyone just wants to put their data in those and not have to worry about them. But the open source big data stack was designed for this on-prem world where you had, you know, like five engineering teams at Yahoo that could run a file system and a Hive meta store and a Zookeeper and all that stuff. And these have different assumptions, like file system has a stronger consistency model, and they're also just harder to manage, and they're not, you know, serverless. So how can big data systems fully leverage these things? I'll just give a brief example. Sorry, I'm a little bit running over, but almost done. I'll just talk about, let's say you just want to run a Spark job and write output in parallel and create a directory with a bunch of output. So the way Hadoop and Spark do this on HDFS is you make a temp directory, you run all your tasks, they each write a file in it. If any tasks fail, you delete the files and stuff they were creating, and then you just rename the directory to the path that your users expect. And they know, because the rename is atomic, when they see that, it's done. Something like S3 does not have directories or atomic renames. So what you have to do is you directly write to your output partitions, and then you can't rename these, and so clients might see them right away. So people have all these weird conventions, like let's maybe make a file called done that says, oh, this directory is actually ready to use. But there are problems. You know, if a task crashes, like maybe you thought it crashed, but actually it's still writing a file, you'll end up with this extra file. There's also eventual consistency. And if you think of harder cases like appending to a data set instead of creating a new one, it's kind of a mess. So what we do in Delta Lake is very simple. We just build a layer on top of this object store that says which objects are actually part of this version of a data set. So super simple. And that we store in a write-ahead log that is itself in S3 and is compressed and is fast to query. So you get the same reliability and speed of querying that metadata. And what that does is there's just this other service that manages the write-ahead log, but now readers can see exactly the files they need to when it's finished. Also turns out to be a lot faster than listing files on S3. And so just as an example of the impact, before we did this, around half of the Spark-related issues we got were things due to cloud storage, like my job crashed and there's junk, stuff is half written, and all of those went away after we did this. This enables us to do a lot of other cool databasey stuff. I won't have time to talk about all of it, but both things like indexing, where we can keep an index in sync transactionally with the data, and audit logging and time travel and stuff like that. And it just made it a lot simpler to build applications. So that's a, you know, just an example. So I'm running a little bit over, so just to conclude, the cloud is enabling much better software products. It's gonna be around. I think all new software will be developed for the cloud first. Maybe they'll ship it on-premise. It's hard to build products, if you want to learn about it, I would say go work on one of these and just see it in action. It's the best way to see it. And there are many research opportunities. And if you do want to look at Databricks specifically, we have three engineering offices where we are hiring. So, thanks.
All right, thanks, Matej. So we have time for questions, a few questions here. Carlo, let me give you the mic.
Thank you so much. This is super interesting and very useful. So you're one of the few people that can answer this question really well.
Sure.
You're both in industry and in academia, and you're presenting all of the new challenges that come with the cloud. Do you think we are training students the right way to be sort of cloud builders, either, you know, the kind of people that will work for Databricks or for the cloud vendors, or even people that just build applications in the cloud?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we could do more. I mean, we are training students to be, to know a lot of technical stuff and to be problem solvers and, you know, and to be smart and all that stuff. But in terms of like the specific issues that you see, I think it's really hard to appreciate them and especially come up with like impactful research ideas unless you've seen them and worked on them yourself. So just to, and I do think the best way is to go in, like don't have any notions about what matters, just see what's actually a problem and how would you solve it. Just my own getting started in this, actually, when I went to grad school in my first summer, you know, everyone was off, was going to do internships in like industry research labs and they wanted to publish a paper in them and stuff. I was really interested in this MapReduce stuff, and Jan, my advisor, said, oh, if you want to do that, don't go to these industry research labs. Go to this like small company, Facebook. It was about 300 engineers at the time, and they were trying to set up the open source Hadoop stack and like do data analysis. So he said, okay, those are the users of these big data systems. Those are the ones where, like, if you make them successful, your work will have impact. So just go in there and see what's hard for them. And that's like the only internship I did, but I learned so much stuff there that I could keep working on it for 4 years. So, yeah.
Other questions?
So another question, in those types of, you know, cloud systems where the provider keeps upgrading the system and the users just keep using it, how do you make sure that customers don't have performance regressions or all kinds of other regressions that might not be part of your test suite.
Yeah, that's a great question. No, there will definitely, some regressions will happen. You can keep improving your test suite, but there's a few pieces. One of them is to have a way to roll it back. And then the other thing is you want to monitor things and ideally catch them before they're an issue and maybe even fix them before anyone even notices that it's an issue. One of the hardest things for us, and this goes back to sort of starting with these on-prem systems, is actually regressions in the version of Spark that we release or Databricks runtime, right? It's changing. And also, these are production jobs. Someone writes the job and then wants to keep running it for like 2 years without worrying about it. They don't want to upgrade the job every 6 months because there's a Spark release. So we do let them launch different versions of it. And within each version of Spark, we have very conservative maintenance patches, like usually just for security things. But that is a question. I would love to have more jobs where we can safely change things and how we run them. Yeah.
So let's take one last question since we're running behind.
Hi, this is Mohit from AWS Clue. Couple of questions about Delta. Do you allow record level inserts? And second, you mentioned 50% of the issues were because of storage. Is that really the case, or that was 50% of something?
Yeah. I can answer both. So yeah, sorry I kind of rushed through it. I didn't manage the time exactly the best way here. But yeah, so one huge thing that happens, and this is why I put in GDPR, is people want to go back and update these data sets. So with GDPR in Europe, a user can say, please delete all the data you have about me. And now there are records in these like thousands of Parquet files with that user. So this is the type of thing where without Delta, if you just had files in S3 and you had people trying to read the data set and you went ad hoc trying to update them, it would be kind of a disaster because you can't even like replace all the objects at once atomically. With Delta, we can do this. We can have a job that replaces the right files and then makes them all appear at once. And if that fails, there's no kind of garbage left over. So that is an important use case. There's also, I mentioned this background optimization. So people like to load data sets quickly, which means lots of small objects, but then you want to consolidate them into big objects for read efficiency, and we also do that automatically and transparently in our service so that readers can just read it and get good performance. And yeah, these issues, I mean, we get, so like again, we mostly want to sell a product that works by itself, but if a user runs into an issue with the workload, they can open a support ticket, and yeah, about half of our support tickets were things like, I got a file not found exception on S3, which is an eventual consistency thing, or my job crashed, but now my table is in a corrupted state, like there's some duplicate stuff. So it was a huge, there are also performance ones, like, oh, this job is really slow. Why is it slow? Oh, it's because I have a million objects and I'm trying to list them in S3 and that's super slow. So they really went away. And for especially, we want to target users who do not have huge software engineering teams that can like read the Spark source code and help with this. It makes a huge difference, yeah.
All right, so let's thank the speaker one more time.